Okay, how do I sound? Good? How do I look? It's the next question. For all of you on the podcast, Shannon said I looked marvelous, and that is an understatement. We're talking about Lamentations. We need some jokes up front, friends. All right. Good morning to those of you who have not met me before. My name is Katie Ranum. I'm a longtime, 8-year member of this church. I've been on the preaching team for about 3 years, and I teach history over at Xavier University. I am the third in this series on Lamentations. It's our third Sunday of Lent, and I am the first preacher in the series to not be named after an Old Testament prophet. Jeremiah and Daniel preached the previous 2 weeks. Our pastoral staff, Jeremiah and Daniel, who's our seminary student and our intern. Is intern the right word, Daniel? Sure, he says, sure. So I'm going to repeat some of the excellent work that they have done up at the beginning for two reasons. One, if you haven't been here for Lent yet, I don't want you to come in the middle of the book in Lamentations and wonder what is going on. So for those of you who have not been here, I'm going to repeat some of the good work that they brought to us. And if you have been here, we learn from repetition, right? If we hear something once, that's great. But the more times we hear it, it builds an architecture of knowledge and understanding in our brains. So if you have been here before for the previous two Sundays of Lent, this is going to help reinforce the material you've already heard so that we can move forward with greater knowledge and understanding. So here is how I'm going to proceed today. There are going to be 4 parts to my sermon. One is going to be covering that brief background on what the book of Lamentations is. The second is I'm going to talk about the structure and the content of the third chapter, the very middle chapter of Lamentations. Then I'm going to dive into what we can learn from this thing that we've now heard in 3 portions. It's a longer reading, so we broke it into 3 sections today. And finally, I am going to conclude with a group activity. I have selected a piece of fine art, one of the best known pieces of fine art of the 20th century, and we're going to have it up on the back, and we're going to talk about it together, and you guys are going to give me your impressions and your analysis of it to see what that can teach us about lament and how it can maybe solidify some of the things that we're going to talk about earlier. So first, a little bit of background. Shannon, could I have the slide on the definition of lament? Thank you so much. It's my first time with the earpiece. I'm getting used to it. Daniel and Jeremiah both used this definition of lament, if it's not familiar to you, and it was so good, I thought we have to keep this going. Lament is an expression of sorrow or grief, based on the recognition that things aren't as they should be, directed at God in the hope that he can and will act. Lament is its own phenomenon. It's different from complaining. It's even different from grieving. It has a very specific purpose, and it has a very specific audience. Now, scholars of the book of Lamentation are almost unanimous that this was written in the wake of the conquest of Jerusalem in 587 BC by the Babylonians. Now, this was not the beginning of the struggle with the Babylonians. The Israelite people had actually been under partial conquest by the Assyrians and then the Babylonian Empire for about 100 years leading up to this moment. But this conquest of Jerusalem and the ensuing exile was a massive, massive calamity in the lives of the people that experienced it, and then generations that came after that, and it is still remembered in Jewish religious life as a major trauma. Lamentations is 5 poems memorializing the experience, the fear, the pain, and the insistence that God act in the result of this specific historic event. Now, what is so fascinating about Lamentation is that each of these 5 chapters, it's not just a poem, it is an acrostic poem, all 5 of them. An acrostic is a poem where each line or stanza starts with the next letter of, in this case, the Hebrew alphabet. But if this was a poem in English, first line would start with A, or the first stanza with A, the next one with B, C, moving on. But chapter 3 is so long, it's 66 stanzas, that it actually, each stanza starts with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and every line, all three lines inside that stanza, starts with that starting letter. So again, to use the English language example, stanza A, A-A-A, B, B-B-B, C, C-C-C. So the content and structure of chapter 3 is highly organized. Simultaneously, it is highly chaotic. We had three readers read this poem in three chunks. Maybe if we had read it together, it would be more obvious that there is a change in narrative voice that happens at least twice in this poem. We'll go from a single voice, a single narrator, to a second narrator, and back again. The language is chaotic. It describes violence, hunger, grief. It has accusation in it. It has violent and disturbing imagery that adds to the chaos. Now, these two internal turning points in the 66 stanzas create three distinct sections to the poem. And so I want to examine those three. The first part, read by Jeffrey, is narrated by the man, or the man of affliction. Now, what is very interesting is that the previous two chapters of Lamentation were actually narrated in a female voice. Jerusalem is exemplified, is personified by this Lady Zion, and much of the text talks about what women experience and fear that they will experience during warfare. We've now had a switch on the first day of Women's History Month, or the first Sunday of Women's History Month. We are now in a distinctly masculine voice, giving voice to the fears and the realities of what men face during warfare. Shannon, could you move to slide number 2 for me? Thank you. So this first part is narrated by the man, and this first section that is about 1 through verse 20 uses very evocative language of what happens in the chaos of siege, warfare, and conflict. Verses 7 through 9, the man says, he, and he's talking about God here, has walled me in so I cannot escape. He has weighed me down with chains. Even when I call out or cry for help, he shuts out my prayer. He has barred my way with blocks of stone. He's made my paths crooked. These verses are deeply claustrophobic. They make me think of reports of people who have survived being buried under rubble, whether it's from a bombing or from an earthquake. No one could hear me cry for help. This also makes me think of what the ghost of Robert Marley tells Ebenezer Scrooge in A Christmas Carol when he describes in graphic detail the ponderous, invisible chain that Scrooge has been forging out of his evil deeds and that will weigh him down after his death. Even more frightening than this claustrophobia is the fact that the man is not blaming the very real human agents that are besieging his city, but the God who is supposed to be his champion and protector. In fact, the Old Testament scholar and Fuller Seminary professor, Dr. John Golden Gay, says that the problem in Lamentations is not the absence of God. It's the presence of God. This is in such direct contrast to Isaiah's praise and rejoicing in chapter 40, verse 4, where he says, every valley shall be exalted and every hill brought low. The crooked places shall be made straight and the rough places smooth. The second part begins in verse 21, and here the man reflects, or rather the second narrative voice begins to reflect on what wisdom can be gained from this extremely painful experience. And I want to be cautious here. this area contains probably the most famous verses from Lamentations, certainly for Christians, but probably across the board. And as I was reading both current Jewish and Christian theologians here, Christian theologians in the 21st century, and Jewish theologians who are writing after the Shoah, after the Holocaust, they were very cautious to warn their reader that we shouldn't read the entirety of Lamentations through these hopeful verses in the middle. It's the middle, it's not the conclusion of this poem, and it's not the conclusion of the book. The voice is going to transition back into anguish and agony and an insistence that God act. So on slide number 3, there are, though, memorable and notable verses. In fact, you probably recognize these from church music that you've heard throughout your life. Through the Lord's mercies, we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him. Those are verses 20 through 24. In his commentary on this portion, the 16th century rabbi Moshe Alshish says, I can see that God treats me as if he were a part of me, not to the contrary. For wherever I have gone into exile, the divine presence has followed me. And here Rabbi Alshish is referring to Talmud Megillah 29a. To continue his quotation, he says, since the divine presence is with me, therefore I will hope for him. That is, I hope that his right hand will save me. We find in several places that the salvation of God is the cause of the salvation of Israel, because he will not allow his divine presence to remain long in exile. But as I said before, the poem does not stay in this mode. It doesn't stay in this voice. Again, we see another narrative shift. We see a return to an anguished voice, pleading with God to reverse the outcome of the calamity and to restore Israel and fulfill his promises to the people of Israel. Oh, she got it even before I asked for it. It's like we're in sync. This is fantastic. The poet says in verses 43 to 45, you have covered yourself with anger and pursued us. You have slain without pity. You have covered yourself with a cloud that prayer cannot get through. You have made us scum and refuse amongst the nations. I found this section even more terrifying than the first part. I have not lived through a warfare situation, although I will say when I was attending a church in Columbus, my home church growing up, we had a number of church members that had lived through prolonged warfare situations and must have found those beginning verses extremely evocative and even terrifying. The terror of God refusing to hear our prayers must be potent not only for people who have experienced prolonged situations of violence, whether in their home or their neighborhood or in their nation, but also for people who have experienced persistent physical and mental health collapse, depression, anxiety, psychosis. There's so much in these verses that evoke Jesus' cry on the cross where he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? There are three distinct parts of this poem, and all the parts are present, and they are all insistent in their expression of reality. I think it would be a disservice that we just go to that middle part, that that's all that we remember, or that we shift it around so that it's the conclusion of the verses. Instead, Professor Golden Gay says that we are invited into the tensive interplay of unresolvable and open dialogue in this chapter and in this book. So I want to pause here. This actually isn't in my notes, but I want to pause and just add an additional invitation here. Jeffrey leads our prayer time at the beginning before any of us do any of the work of worship, leading worship, and I'm always so grateful for that. And it gives us a chance to pray for each other and to pray for the congregation, the visitors that will come in. So I want to say at this point, if this is you, if you are the afflicted person, if you are part of an afflicted group, and you are living with persistent and prolonged violence or fear or collapse of your body or your mind, you are welcome here. And we can tell by the fact, whatever your theological belief about how the Bible was constructed, it is obvious to me that there is hospitality for that human experience in a persistent and prolonged way. It's here for thousands of years in this text. I presume if God did not want it to be here, was impatient or intolerant with it, he, through whatever mechanism, would not have allowed it to end up in our text. So if you are here, and you are afraid, and you are in pain, you are not alone in that. And if you need to tell someone about that, or you need to tell all of us about that, that is what the body of the believing church does. So what can we learn from this chapter? Up front, there's one thing that I need to admit I'm not qualified actually to address, but it is very present in this chapter, which is the various voices of the poem talk about the relationship of sin to suffering. I just didn't feel like that was something that I was able to get into today. I wanted to address some other things, and it may be above my pay grade, honestly, at this time. So that is something I'm going to leave to some other scholars. But these are my three takeaways that I want to address from contemplating Lamentations 3. One is that engaging with this text asks us to have stamina and endurance with what Golden Gate called this tensive interplay and open dialogue, these unresolved parts of scripture and human experience. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, the Apostle Paul is writing to some of his churches that he's planted, and he's frustrated with them because he believes, to use his metaphor, that they should be mature enough at this point to be able to eat spiritual meat, but instead they're like little babies who are still drinking spiritual milk. A demand for immediate and easy answers rather than being acceptive of this tension is one of the things that can keep us in immaturity. In fact, if you are looking at religious groups or religious leaders and you discover that they have a fast and easy and complete answer for everything, this is a red flag. These are often either immature religious groups or what religious scholars call high control groups, because they have to squash dissent in order to keep up the ruse that they have the answers for everything. The God of the Bible, on the other hand, is comfortable with our anger and our questions and the complexity. And so even if we don't feel that we're able to become comfortable with this as well, in imitation of the God who has chosen us and who has invited us to follow him, we ought to do this as well in imitation. We ought to make space for difficult and complex and incomplete answers. And that stamina, number two, as we mature and we get to be okay with not getting our questions answered immediately and all the time, that enables us to honor the people around us who are suffering. Whether this is a corporate suffering that we are observing, but that is external to us, or individual and private suffering. Any of us who have had tragedies in our lives know how, not frustrating is the world, insulting it is when someone hears our suffering and gives us a fast, easy answer. And if you are one of those people that suffers, Rabbi Elshish and Christian theologians insist that God suffers with us. So number three, I really want to encourage this group because most of us come through a heritage from a very particular geographic and intellectual and philosophical tradition that really values individualism. And therefore, we tend to, as 21st century Christians, read all kinds of texts in the Bible individually and as individual experiences. And this is very clearly a corporate expression of a nationwide tragedy and experience. And when we push ourselves to think outside of that, it develops more stamina in us that actually allows us to be compassionate and then to be willing to take action. So just as biblical lament, remember that very first quote, biblical lament asks God to act. When we learn the patience to listen to our neighbors who are lamenting out loud, we are putting ourselves in the position where we are accepting the possibility that we may need to act. This is one of the reasons why it's so common for us who are not actively suffering to want to like silence and squash the pain of the people around us. Their cry demands that we take action that we may not want to take. So what is this philosophical tradition that we come from that so values not only privatizing these texts, individualizing these texts, but squashing lament? Well, I'll tell you, it's the Greco-Roman tradition. In Greco-Roman society, the heirs of Aristotle and his entourage really privileged reason over emotion. Hebrew culture and scripture does not have this problem, this dichotomy, but the Greco-Roman and therefore the Western tradition does. So in this ancient model, citizenship, to be a man worthy of citizenship, you had to exhibit this kind of embodied and emotional control and privileging of reason over the expression of emotion. It was women and slaves and others who were not qualified for citizenship who were expected to be subject to their own emotions and therefore bodily displays of it. And American history and culture has replicated this preference for silence. And those of us who, in the original writing of some of these foundational texts, were not considered worthy of citizenship, have often then imitated and replicated the silencing of others so that we might be considered worthy of citizenship. Silencing our own lament or the lament of our neighbors so that we could be seen in this very male rational model as worthy to have representatives and a vote. So I have a confession here. I've experienced this from both sides. I've both been a person who, when I've been angry and in pain, people have told me to be quiet, very, very literally be quiet. And I have done that to other people. When other groups that have been experiencing pain that I was not witnessing or I was not experiencing, and I didn't want to enter into that pain with them, I have told them to be quiet. When we honor lament, we listen to it. When we listen to it, we suffer with the afflicted person or group. And when we suffer, we have to act and maybe we have to change, which is terrifying. We're likely going to have prayer later, corporate prayer later. I would invite you to think potentially of a group to which you do not belong or a person who is not you, that you know is suffering and maybe is calling out for our attention through lament. And if you feel called in corporate prayer, let's name some of those people and some of those groups. Okay. I've had my chance to talk. Now I'm going to invite you into this process here. Could I please have Pablo Picasso's Guernica from 1937. Is there any fiddling maybe we can do with lights? Is that possible? It's all in grayscale, so it might be a little bit challenging to see. Thank you, Meg. Thank you, Meg. A little bit better. Has anyone seen this image in person? Has anybody?
hand for the win.
I did not expect any hands. I don't know why I asked. Serves me right. Family full of attorneys. Never ask a question you don't know the answer to. Would anybody be willing to tell me what you see in this image? Anything you see, either a large observation or something specific. Yeah, Lorianne. Yeah. Far stage right, the woman holding the dead infant and crying out to the sky. On the left side for you, yes. Stage right, left for the audience, yes, yes. Other observations, other things that you see. Violent suffering. Disembodiment, yep. Confusion. Distortion. Light and darkness. Helplessness. Would you, audience, call this an organized image or a chaotic image, or would you give it another designation? I hear a lot of chaos. Yeah. Does anyone know what was happening in Spain in 1937, either specific to that year or in the decades? Yeah, Tim. The Spanish Civil War. Excellent. Guernica was painted over the course of only 35 days in 1937. So the middle of the Spanish Civil War, in which Spanish Republicans and Spanish fascists were competing for control over the government. And in the course of that struggle, Francisco Franco invited the German military, who was already under the control of the Third Reich, to bomb the spiritual homeland of the Basque people. They're an ethnic minority in Europe. They span France and Spain. And they did so, killing over 1,600 civilians. This painting has become one of the most famous anti-war paintings of all time. I don't remember if it was this exact canvas or if it was a replica hung in the UN for a long period of time. And Picasso actually had to paint it in Paris because he was an exile from Spain because he was against the fascists. Unfortunately for him, he was in Spain when the Nazis invaded and conquered Paris. And allegedly, a Nazi officer approached him after seeing this painting and gesturing at it, said, "Did you do this?" In what is possibly the hottest take in art history, Picasso replied, "No, you did." He survived that encounter. This is simultaneously a highly chaotic and highly organized image. But the chaos is intentional. Your eye doesn't know where to go. It's constantly darting around the canvas. It's an enormous canvas, by the way, right, Lorianne? It's huge. And in it, there are images of a dead soldier, a dead and decapitated soldier lying along the bottom, a horse with a spear through it who's in the throes of death, a woman who is on fire, a mother grieving her infant, and a bull. Picasso refused to explain all the imagery in this painting. He felt like it was up to the reader to wrestle with it and struggle with it. What Golden Gay said, maybe engage in an open dialogue with it. Picasso was obsessed with bulls and the violent and masculinely violent imagery of the Minotaur and the mythology of the Minotaur. People have speculated that the presence of the bull is Picasso himself, that it is Spanish machismo, that it is Francisco Franco, that it's the fascist party, that it's bullfighting and Spanish identity. But he would never say. There's mystery in this image. But what you come away with is knowing something happened. It caused destruction. It is not resolved. And the reason it hung in the UN for such a long time was the body of the UN's job was to continue to mediate and address the repeated events of violence that continue to occur around the world. Shannon, could we leave this up during communion? I believe that, Meg, are you going to lead communion? Meg's going to come up. And she's going to lead us through the Lord's Supper, something that Christians have done, and when referring to the Passover Supper that Jews have done for thousands of years, in the midst of exile, in the midst of personal and corporate suffering, in the midst of unresolved, open, ongoing dialogue with the God that we believe sees us, suffers with us, hears us, redeems us, and has not put a period on the sentence that is the human experience.